What is up, my friends? How are you out there in podcast land? I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Don Delgandio here, the oldest kid in the class, sitting in the back of the room. I gotta start by saying this. I had such a blast doing that first episode, and I said, you know, I want to do it again. So I figured, why the heck not? Now, for those of you who took the time to punch me up and give me a listen, I thank you sincerely. But if you haven't, well, chances are you're not listening to this show either. I need to get a drum roll or a laugh track or something. I really am a funny guy. At least I try to be anyway. But so anyway, the name of this podcast is Are You Listening? And what we're going to talk about today in this episode, I want to talk about disc jockeys. And a lot of the time, the disc jockeys, they kind of hide themselves. They kind of go like behind the scenes, or they're kind of hidden behind the scenes. I don't think people realize how important disc jockeys are, and I touched on this very briefly in my introduction in episode one. And you know, DJs really are the folks who introduce us to the songs that we hear. I like to call them messengers. You know, they're really messengers. And they're the links, and they're the bridges between us, the listener, and them, the performers. Performers owe their entire careers, everything about their careers, to disc jockeys. Because without disc jockeys playing their records on the air, performers would really have no career. Now that there have been, there have been DJs and there have been icons. And by icons, I'm talking about those on-air personalities who, if they played your record on their show, on their air, you know you made it. Now, I'm from New Jersey. I grew up literally on the shores of the Raritan Bay, right across from New York City. So I grew up listening to some really famous people, some really famous on-air personalities. Scott Shannon, I listen to him every morning, and I have since high school, and even before that, since elementary school. You know, I especially loved him when he did the morning show with Todd Pettengill on the now defunct WPLJ in New York. And there was Cousin Brucey, who's still going strong. I was just listening to him over the weekend. Excuse me. And there was Harry Harrison, the late Harry Harrison, the late Dan Ingram. I remember listening to Jim Kerr and Pat St. John and Scott Muni. Some other examples of legendary DJs would, the great Dick Clark and Wolfman Jack. If you're into country and western music, listen, they're Ralph Emery of the famous WSM in Nashville. And believe it or not, another famous DJ, probably the most famous DJ to come out of WSM. And by the way, before I tell you who that famous DJ is, WSM is who brings us the Grand Ole Opry every Saturday night. And that's been going on for probably, if I have my dates right, probably close to 100 years, 100 years. So that's WSM is a very important radio station in our country and in our culture when it comes to country music. But anyway, a very famous DJ that used to perform, or I should say, I should, well, I guess you could say perform, but he used to work at WSM. A guy by the name of Pat Sajak, who is now the host of Wheel of Fortune for probably the good, last 35, almost 40 years. So anyway, for this episode, I'd actually like to focus on a guy who, without him, I don't know. Without him, I don't think any of this would be possible. Would it have happened? Well, I guess so. Maybe not as quickly as it did. This whole rock and roll being part of our culture, rock and roll music changing, really changing the history or creating a history, and being such a big part of our culture, I'm not too sure. And rock and roll is still here. I'd like to talk about a guy named Albert James Fried. We know him better as Alan Fried. And if you don't know who Alan Fried is, well, all I can say is, again, an entire culture wouldn't even exist. And yet, unfortunately, many people have absolutely no clue who he is. So, this December, we actually celebrate his 100th birthday. It would have been his 100th birthday. He was born in December of 1921, and he called himself the King of the Moondoggers. And he was a disc jockey who first found fame on WJW in Cleveland. And I'm going to tell you more on why that's so important in a few minutes. But a fun and interesting fact is that he was born in Pennsylvania. He was raised in Ohio. And before he started the cultural movement that we all know and love as rock and roll, he was actually a trombone player in his high school band in Salem, Ohio. When I researched all this, I just thought, wow, how cool. And he had aspirations of becoming a band leader, and he idolized such band leaders as Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw. And in fact, the name of his big band, ironically enough, his band was called the Sultans of Swing. And ironically, depending on the interpretation or the story that you hear, this was very loosely referenced in the song of the same name by Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing by Dire Straits. And the specific lyric is, "They don't give a damn about any trumpet playing band. It ain't what they call rock and roll." Now, interpret that for yourself. But that's pretty damn cool, I gotta tell you. So anyway, Alan Freed got interested in radio while he was a student at Ohio State. He was a Buckeye, right? Where he was studying mechanical engineering, of all things. And, he worked at some small stations in Pennsylvania and Ohio, even working as a sportscaster. This is all before, he just created this pop culture phenomenon. I mean, and he was playing jazz music and the popular songs of the day, which is what he loved, you know. And his first big break as a DJ came at WAKR in Akron, Ohio. Like I said, where he was playing, you know, the jazz music and the pop music of the day. If you listen to, you know, a radio station or an old recording of, you know, say maybe a, you know, maybe a Benny Goodman or a, you know, even a Frank Sinatra or a Nat King Cole, that's pretty much what he was playing. That's pretty much what Alan Freed was playing on the air back in those days. And that was around 1945. That was right at the end of World War II. And he became locally popular, and he left the station. I'm sure you could figure out why. There was a salary dispute. So he moved to Cleveland, and you know, he went to the city, the big city. And when he went to Cleveland, he was actually looking for a job on a new medium called television. He was looking to be on television. He had a friend who owned a record store, and his friend's name was Leo Mintz, Mintz. And Mintz, like I said, he owned a record store, and he sold a lot of R&B records, rhythm and blues records. And he pretty much made that aware, you know, he made Alan Freed aware of the music that was selling the most. You know, the popular records of that time and of that area, you know, of the country. His friend, Leo Mintz, connected him to radio station WJW. And Mintz sponsored a show that would eventually be hosted by Alan Freed, spotlighting those rhythm and blues records that were among the best sellers at his record store. And Alan Freed was quite hesitant about playing this music. He knew that he would probably get some backlash. Why do I say that? You figure this was late 40s, you know, going into the 50s, and there was, you know, there was a lot of racial tension. You know, radio stations that played quote unquote white music wouldn't even touch quote unquote black music. And they actually called that music race records. You know, so there was, you know, Alan Freed, it's not that he was, you know, Alan Freed he was blind to color. He didn't care about the color of people's skin. He didn't want backlash. He was hesitant about the backlash. And he was playing these quote unquote race records on a white radio, you know, a white radio station. Very segregated at the time, and it was, you know, it was pretty sad when you really think about it, those times. Now, remember, he also wanted to lead his own big band. He was a jazz kid, and he really didn't know anything about these, you know, this rhythm and blues music, so it wasn't what he was used to hearing, but it. He loved what he heard. It started to grow on him. and he liked what he saw. He liked what he heard. He liked what he saw. He saw how popular it was, especially with the younger crowd, and how they responded to it. And Fried and trying to describe, and this is actually pretty cool. In trying to describe this music, he actually called it rock and roll, and it was how can I in trying to describe this rhythmic music, he called it rock and roll because which believe it or not, it was actually a it was rock and roll was actually a slang term for sex. And this was in the early 1950s, and so he was playing music that was not heard anywhere else. Not many people were playing this music, giving this music the light of day. And he capitalized on the frenzy he was causing. And by this time, the big band, the swing, and the jazz music was getting stale. People wanted more. People wanted something different. And in order to capitalize on this frenzy, Freed decided to organize something called the Moondog Coronation Ball. The Moondog Coronation Ball, which to this day, believe it or not, is considered the very first rock and roll concert. And he would organize these concerts. When he got to New York later on, and Boston, and wherever he was working, but he wanted to give his listeners an experience, or the experience of seeing and interacting with the singers of these songs, these performers. And so anyway, this Moondog Coronation Ball, or what would be cons what is considered the very first rock and roll concert, it was actually held on March 21st, 1952. Still over 3 years before Rock Around the Clock, over 4 years before the rise in popularity of Elvis Presley. So on March 21st, 1952, at the Cleveland Arena, 20,000 people showed up to see their musical heroes perform live. It was a great concept. The only problem was that the Cleveland Arena only held about 10,000 people. And after dealing with people trying to crash the gates, the whole thing was canceled. And Freed became so popular that he took the show to the big time, New York City. And when he got to New York City, he signed with WINS. Now, I live in the New York City market. I live in New Jersey, literally still right across the bay from New York City. WINS is still around, but it's a news talk station now. So, but it used to be one of the biggest rock and roll radio stations in the area. And by playing these records on the air and giving the fans opportunities to actually see their favorite performers live, he brought this obscure music to the mainstream. And like I said before, skin color was not an issue. It was all about the music with him. Alan Freed, had this vision, and he thought, man, this music, it needs to be heard. and so skin color was not an issue. And this new music was becoming insanely popular with all people, white and black. Like I said, it was all about the music and famous concerts. He organized famous concerts at the Brooklyn Paramount Theater and the Manhattan Paramount Theater. And he featured such huge acts as like Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, really any of the popular acts of the day. It didn't matter where you came from. People of all races and walks of life were embracing this music that Freed was introducing and bringing to light. However, all this became a problem. And the music, rock and roll, was condemned. It was considered by parents and clergy, even news media and community leaders, as they called it obscene. Radio stations banned it from their airwaves. In fact, there's a story not related to Alan Freed, but in 1957, Elvis Presley recorded a version of Irving Berlin's White Christmas. It was on Elvis's first Christmas album. And Irving Berlin hated, absolutely hated Elvis's recording so much that he demanded that any DJ who played it on the air be fired immediately. And rock and roll was considered evil, the devil's music. They even went so far as to call it jungle music. And it was believed to, they thought it would cause juvenile delinquency. I mean, just unbelievable. And Freed became such a huge target. But he became so popular, he did two shows on WINS. He was so popular and so important to the music of that time, he would get songwriting credits and song royalties for simply playing the songs on the radio. It's unbelievable. I was amazed when I researched that. And that would bite him. That would bite him in the butt later on, and I'll tell you why. But he was so popular and so important, he appeared in movies. And in the summer of 1957, he decided to take the show to television. He took his radio show to television. It was a show called The Big Beat, which aired on Friday nights on ABC. It was a show much like Dick Clark's American Bandstand. And it featured the acts whose records he was playing on the radio and kids dancing. And unfortunately, as mentioned before, he was a huge target. And advertisers, television stations, especially in the South, took exception to the fact that black performers, such as specifically Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Frankie Lyman was dancing on the air with a white girl. And because of this, ABC canceled the Big Beat. ABC canceled the show. Then there was an incident in Boston, and Freed, decided to take the live shows on the road. And in May of 1958, it was no exception. And Boston at that time was very much strictly run. It was very influenced by the Catholic Church. Radio stations in Boston were known to ban certain rock and roll records from their airwaves. "Wake Up Little Susie" by the Everly Brothers is one of the songs that comes to mind. And Freed tried to be extra defiant with the police, accusing them of, you know, not wanting those in attendance to have a good time. So, you know, something that had to do with, you know, Alan Freed wanted the lights, the house lights dim, and the police insisted on keeping them on so that they could see what was going on. And Alan Freed, you know, basically was like, oh, the police don't want you guys to have a good time. And this caused those in attendance to rush the stage. Fights broke out afterwards outside the arena and the subways, and Freed was charged with incitement of riots. And the rest of the tour was canceled. This, some other things, you know, that Freed was involved with, caused WINS in New York to fire their big star. And he'd go back, he'd do more television. ABC decided that they were going to launch a reboot of The Big Beat. Actually, no, I'm sorry. He wound up back on ABC with another show, but Freed wound up doing a reboot of The Big Beat show on New York's Dumont station, which today is known as WNYW Channel 5. That's New York's Fox affiliate. But anyway, as mentioned earlier, Freed's fame and influence caused him to become a target. He found himself involved in what became known as the payola scandal. And in case you don't know, payola was when record companies were paying off disc jockeys with money and kickbacks and gifts, etc. Dick Clark even testified before Congress about it. Record companies would pay DJs lots of money to very heavily play their records on the air. And a few years earlier, you know, it happened right around the time. A few years earlier, there was a quiz show scandal where producers of television game shows would literally give the answers to questions to their to the contestants appearing on the show. Two of the most famous cases of this was the $64,000 question and a show called 21. And one piece of fascinating trivia concerning the quiz show scandal and the 21 show, the original host of 21 at the time of the scandal was a guy named Jack Barry. And although the scandal just about ruined his career, he would later reemerge. He would later host, in the 1970s, there was a show called The Joker's Wild. And I remember watching that show with my dad. But anyway, back to Alan Freed. Like those involved in the quiz show scandal, Alan Freed's career was just about ruined in the payola scandal. He didn't deny at all that he had been paid by record companies, but he insisted that he was being paid for consulting. And he maintained that because of his influence, record companies would ask for his input. And in 1960, Freed would be charged with bribery, guilty of taking, and this is the exact dollar amount, when I did my research on this whole thing, he was guilty of taking, it was Freed and I think six or seven other DJs around the country, $116,850 in bribes. In today's money, that would be over $1 million in bribes. So it wasn't good for Alan Freed. And he would work briefly at KDAY in Los Angeles, where he continued to influence and promote records, but soon after trying to stage a concert at the Hollywood Bowl, he was fired by the station. They wanted nothing to do. I get, the station heard all about what happened in Cleveland and New York and Boston. They wanted no part of it, so they fired him. And by this time, Freed suffered through so many legal troubles that, not only stemming from the scandal, but from charges of income tax evasion. And this all took such a toll on Freed, and he basically drank himself to death. Cirrhosis of the liver caused gastrointestinal bleeding, which led to kidney failure, which led to his death in January of 1965 at the way too young age of 43 years old. So, in his short life, he started a movement and became one of the most important people in the history of music. You have Bach, and you have Beethoven, and you have Elvis and Sinatra, and you have Alan Freed. That's how important he was. And really, without Alan Freed, would there be an Elvis? You got to ask yourself that question. Would there be an Elvis? Would there be a Chuck Berry? We might never know that, but it's a very deep thought. Alan Freed was remembered. They made a film about him, 1978. It was called American Hot Wax. And it was very loosely very loosely told the story of his influence on, basically exactly what I was just talking about. Although I personally thought it was a great movie, but what do I know? It bombed at the box office. But some fun facts about this film. It was released at that time in 1978. There was a 1950s nostalgia boom. 1950s nostalgia was all the rage. We had TV shows like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. In the early 70s, we had, movies like American Graffiti. And then right around that time, 1978, we had Grease. Now, American Hot Wax bombed. But if you watch it, it's pretty cool to see people like a young Jay Leno, or a young Fran Drescher. Brenda Russell was in it. If you remember her, she had a big song, I guess 10 years after the movie, 1988. She sang a song called "Piano in the Dark," which is a beautiful song. So she sang in one of the girl groups that were featured in the movie, and there were also cameos. Chuck Berry himself was in there. Was in that movie. Jerry Lee Lewis was there. Screamin' Jay Hawkins made a cameo appearance. "I Put a Spell on You." The guy who played Alan Freed was Tim McIntyre, and he wasn't very well known. But a quick fun fact: he actually appeared as the meathead Mike Stivic character in the filmed but unaired pilot episode of what would eventually become All in the Family. In fact, Harrison Ford would later be considered for that role before Rob Reiner perfectly played the part. During the once All in the Family was officially hit the airwaves on CBS, Rob Reiner brilliantly played the part of meathead Mike Stivic. But one final thing that nobody knows about American Hot Wax, And this is kind of, one of those really off the wall things, but in a couple of very quick scenes in the movie, especially at the end of the movie, there's a young man drumming on garbage cans and singing like Little Richard. That's Maurice Starr. He would become a big time record producer, and he was responsible for putting together and managing two of the biggest, hugest groups of the 1980s. He put together New Edition and another group called New Kids on the Block. And he put a group together in the, I think in 1990, featuring his son. And it was a group called Perfect Gentlemen, but they were one-hit wonders. Their only hit was called Ooh La La, I Can't Get Over You, which hit number 10 in the spring of 1990. So, but anyway, back to Alan Freed, and just try to wrap things up here. Freed was inducted into the very first class of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986, along alongside probably the most essential people that should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So Alan Freed was inducted alongside Elvis Presley and Little Richard, and Chuck Berry was inducted in 1986, James Brown, Buddy Holly, Ray Charles, and Sam Cooke. The physical Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was built specifically in Cleveland, and it was put in Cleveland for the very reason that Cleveland is where Alan Freed introduced rock and roll music to the world. And his ashes, for a time, for a very short time, for a couple of years, this was actually the strange news of the day back in the early 2000s. His ashes were actually kept at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they were removed and buried by the family in a nearby cemetery. But ladies and gentlemen, it's, try and wrap things up here. It's my opinion that Alan Freed's contributions to American culture and music history should be a part of any music history curriculum. And unfortunately, I don't think it is. Without the influence of Freed, we would have never had rock and roll music, or no doo-wops, no Elvis, no Buddy Holly, no Happy Days, no Beatles, no Rolling Stones or rap music, no American Pie, no Springsteen, no Nirvana or heavy metal music, to name a few examples. No punk music. Think about how much color Freed would eventually bring into the world. Something that he was severely knocked for back when he was alive. Ladies and gentlemen, he knocked down color barriers. He was blind to color. His only wish was to bring people together. He taught us that music is a universal language which everyone could understand. I think if he were around at least a little while longer than he was, he would definitely be proud of the fact that the music he was instrumental in spreading the message of was heard loud and clear in the lives that were impacted. And as the song by Danny and the Juniors said, rock and roll is here to stay, it will never die. And ladies and gentlemen, you can learn more about Alan Freed on the official Alan Freed website, alanfreed.com, and on the official website of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, rockhall.com. I don't think I can really say enough about Alan Freed and his contributions to our culture. And so ladies and gentlemen, as Alan Freed used to sign off from all of his shows by saying, "It's not goodbye, it's just good night." This is Are You Listening, and thank you so much for listening to my podcast. For now, friends, the show is over. Love one another and go in peace.